I have some in my pocket, but if I have that in my mouth, I can't talk, and that would be a catastrophe.
No, that's what it is. I agree.
Gargled the salt water just before I came. Before that, I drank lemon tea. So I think I'll get through the hour. Okay. Today, we see Job as he turns away from all human help, all human attempts to understand, and he says, "You people have not helped me, are not able to help me. I want to talk to God alone." And that's the reason for this title, God, Explain Yourself to Me. And both the title that I chose, some of the things that Job says during this these speeches that he gives back to the friends, and then the last speech he has, we're going to read part of it, have caused people to say that here Job is self-righteous. And whatever he was before, certainly now, he's a kind of a person that deserves all that he gets. He's so proud and self-satisfied. That's exactly what his friends thought. And our tendency is to feel that as we read it. And so we have to remind ourselves that when this is all over, after he said all the things he says, chapter 42, verse 7, we'll have somebody read it to us. Chapter 42, verse 7 and 8, no matter what we think, this is what God thinks. According to the writer, 42, 7 and 8.
After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord, and to Eliphaz the Kenite, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now, therefore, take seven bulls and seven rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer him for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has."
It was not a mistake that the writer put that there, and he didn't forget what was in the middle. The person who put the book together did that on purpose, because it's his position that Job is sinless, Job hasn't done anything wrong, and it's not wrong for Job to say these things to God. Now, partly why is that true? Job is, as we look at this carefully, a very religious person. In fact, I think the writer is telling us in this book what religiousness is really all about. Number one, the friends do Job two things. The first thing they do for Job is they drive Job away from all human resources. They want to help him, but all they succeed in doing is to make Job realize no one can help him in understanding what's going on. And so he turns away from all human sources. And that's basically where we're all at. We finally have to realize that about much of life, there are no other resources except God himself. Now, the second thing that they've done, and this is not so good, but it shows us the nature of Job. Up until the friends got at Job, Job did not have any doubts about God and the fact that God was his friend. Job had a good relationship to God. But when the friends start to explain Job's situation to him with their good theology, lo and behold, they make Job feel, "God is my enemy. God is against me." Job knows he had a good relation, and there's no reason God should be his enemy. He never thought of God as his enemy, one who was after him to get him. But if you watch what he says, and we don't have time to read them all in his speeches, more and more he begins to ask God, "Why are you my enemy? Why are you doing this to me? We used to be friends. What's gone wrong?" The friends have driven Job to ask the deep question, the religious question, what is God's attitude and relationship to his world and those of us who live in his world? That's a very religious question. Job also has had to, because of what the friend said, Job also, oh, I forgot what I was going to say there. Sorry, I got carried away with that other one. Well, we'll forget it. It may come up. Yes, this is it. And what do the friends do as a service then? They make Job turn to God. And the basic religious attitude, no matter what comes in our life, is that we don't turn away from God, but we turn toward God. And Job does that. If you watch all the way through, that has never changed in Job. His understanding isn't clear, he's ambiguous, but he's always certain he must turn to God, whether it was when he was well off or now with all these problems he can't understand. He turns to God, and that is the basic religious position of human beings in life. Okay, with that kind of a background, I think then what we'll do is look at one of the speeches, chapter 13, and we'll see this process happening, turning away from human resources, turning to God, and then we'll go to those two passages that I said we'd get to, chapter 14 and chapter 19, which are very important. So we're at chapter 13 of the book of Job. Would someone read chapter 13, verses 1 to 10, and I'll interrupt as you read it.
My eyes have seen all this. My ears have heard and understood it.
Okay, he's responding to what the friends have said, and they've told him a lot of things, and he says, I know that. I know everything you've said. Keep going.
What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you, but I desire to speak to the Almighty and to argue my case with God.
Here he turns away from the friends. He said, I'm fed up with you. Now I'm going to bring it to the one person who has to explain himself.
You, however, smear me with lies, and you are worthless. Physicians, all of you. If only you would be altogether silent. For you, that would be wisdom. Hear now my argument. Listen to the plea of my lips. Will you speak wickedly on God's behalf? Will you speak deceitfully for him?
It's too bad it said wickedly there. The RSV has, will you speak falsely for God? And will you speak deceitfully for him? You see, his picture is, you guys are scared stiff of God. You know he's greater than I am. I can't hurt you. You know he can really get you. So when it comes to your trying to decide whether you're going to take my side or God's side, you're always going to take God's side. You'll even speak lies in order to defend him. Go on.
Will you show him partiality? Will you argue for the case of God?
And this is law court language, by the way. Case, plead. Job is envisioning, it comes out in other speeches we don't read, he and God in court. The problem, he says, is God is both the judge and the guy who's the wrongdoer. And how do you come before the wrongdoer and expect that guy to give you justice? But it's all law court language.
Would it turn out well if he examined you? Could you deceive him as you might deceive men?
Notice, will it be well with you when he searches you out? And the answer is, it surely will not, because 42:7, God did search him out. He said they spoke foolishness. Job spoke what was right. I forgot to have you pound on that, but maybe they know we started. Sorry. Go on.
He would surely rebuke you if you secretly showed partiality.
Okay, that's good enough. Now, we're going to skip a few verses and go to 13, chapter 13, verses 13 to 24. This is one of the most important sections in the book of Job, because Job sort of lays down ground rules of how he and God could discuss this matter together. Okay, would someone read verses 13 to 24?
Let me have silence, and I will speak, and let come on me what may.
He's screwing up his courage. He's going to take his life in his hands and address God directly, knowing God could destroy him in a moment. It's a great risk. Okay, keep going.
I will take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands. Behold, he will slay me. I have no hope. Yet I will defend my ways to his face.
That's how sure Job is that he is right. Can you see why people say self-righteous, proud Job? But we know he's right. God has said he's right. So he's not being self-righteous. He's merely speaking the truth. And he says, I'm so sure of it, I'm willing to risk everything in order to come to God and get this straightened out. Go on.
This will be my salvation, that a godless man shall not come before him.
He has a little hope. I'm innocent. If I were guilty, he would destroy me. Since I'm not guilty, I have hope that I can confront him and survive. Go ahead.
Listen carefully to my words, and let my declaration be in your ears.
Speaking now to God.
Behold, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is there that will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die.
Okay, now he's going to put down the ground rules for this discussion. 20 to 24, keep going.
Only grant two things to me. Then I will not hide myself from thy face. Withdraw thy hands far from me, and let not dread of thee terrify me. Then call, and I will answer, or let me speak, and do thou reply to me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgressions and my sin. Why dost thou hide thy face and count me as thy enemy?
These verses are so important. We've got to go through them again a little more carefully, starting at 20. Job says, I only ask two things of you, God, and if you'll give me these two requests, I'm willing to stand in front of you and confront you. So these are sort of the basis on which he's willing to confront God. 21. Withdraw thy hand far from me. Now, there's a sadness in that as well as a truth. Let's take the truth first. Job knows God is behind his suffering. Job, in some passages we haven't read, describes God as a sadistic torturer. And he says, God, you not only brought this all on me, but you keep going after me when I'm down on my deathbed. You don't give me a moment's respite. I can't sleep at night. And during the day, you don't even give me time to swallow my spit before you go after me some more. That's his words. You know, that's the way he talks to God. Sounds like Jeremiah. But anyway, so he says, withdraw your hand from me, which means let me have a little, what do you call it when cancer?
Remission.
Yeah. We have a little remission for God so that I can come before you with a clear mind and present my case in its strongest point. Because in the condition I'm in, I'm too weak. I can't possibly do an adequate job. I said that's the true side. But the sad thing is, Job is driven to request the one thing he doesn't want, that God should withdraw himself from him. Do you see that? Job wants God always to be with him. But he's been driven by the way God seems to be acting in his life to say, God, don't follow me so much. Was it Timia who prayed like that? Mm-hmm. You know, God, that's fine, we're your chosen people, but why don't you work on somebody else for a while? That's Jewish. They love God. They know God is doing everything and in control, but sometimes he's a little heavy-handed about it. And it goes against their whole grain to have to say to God, please hide yourself a bit from me so I don't experience you. Okay, that's the one thing. Give me health enough to do a good job on my defense. Notice the second half of the verse. Let not dread of you terrify me. The second thing all through the book has been Job knows. The friends think they have to tell him, but before the friends said it, Job said it first. God is greater than Job. Job knows that. God is creator. Job is creature. Job knows that if he confronts God, he's got an unequal battle. That's what he meant earlier when he says, lo, my eye has seen all of this, my ear has heard and understood it. You're not telling me anything I don't know. They thought he was being so proud, he thought he was better than God, greater than God. He says, no, I know God is that. And that's what he says. Don't let your greatness, your transcendence, your total otherness destroy me. Give me a chance. Be an equal with me if you can. Now, there are two views of God in life. The one is this totally other, God who is vastly different than anything in creation, than any one of us. And we should stand in awe of him. And when he appears to human beings in the Bible, what's the reaction when you get a vision? They're crushed by it. They fall in front of him, confess their unworthiness or their humanness or their weakness. But there's another side which we know in Christ, God near to us as friend, you see. Job knew both sides too. Job knew God as friend. Job knew God as creator, as awe-inspiring. And he's saying, put that aside, the awe, the transcendence, and come to me in a way a human being can tolerate. Okay, those are two conditions, sort of. Don't let me be so sick, and don't come in all your majesty and all your power, if we want to have a good discussion. Then verse 22, he does an interesting thing. Job gives God a lot of options. You know, and if you're gonna have an argument with somebody, you don't want to put them in a bad situation where they make a choice, they're embarrassed, and they lose face. So Job gives God a lot of options. Notice in 22. Call, and I will answer you. Or, if you don't want to do it that way, let me call, and you answer me. I don't care how you do it, but let's talk about it. That's a cute little way he has. Okay, and now this is what he wants to know in verse 23. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. He had said that to the friends. Do you remember that? They were saying, you're a great sinner. You must be the greatest sinner. That's why these terrible things are happening. And he says, don't talk in general about sin. Point out specifically what I did wrong. And they couldn't. They just keep coming back, seeing how bad off you are. It's obviously you're a terrible sinner. Now Job comes to God and he says, if, as the friends say, I am a terrible sinner, that's what I want you to show me. I don't see it. I'm not aware of it. Show it to me. Convince me, and then I'll believe it. That's the first thing. But that's not the most important thing Job wants from God. Look at the next verse. Why dost thou hide thy face and cop me as thy enemy? That is Job's problem. He had had a good relation with God. All of a sudden, these things come into his life, and his friends have told him that means God's your enemy. And so he says, in effect, if what the friends say is true, that you're my enemy, why? Explain that to me, God. There must be some reason why now you, who used to be my greatest joy in life, and we had such a good relationship, why now are you my enemy? And that's a religious question, a deep religious question. To know whether or not God in our lives is for us or against us. Friend or enemy. We all make the choice as we interpret life. Okay, well, that's the situation. And tomorrow we'll see how God follows the ground rules that Job sets up. Because tomorrow we're going to get the speeches of Yahweh, and we'll see how that fits in with everything that's going on. I'm going to stop there for that, and you can ask questions on what we've just gone over, if you wish, or bring anything up. And then we're going to go to the two passages. Anything you want to bring up from what I brought up here, or something I skipped over you think I should know in those chapters? Nothing? You want those two passages, don't you? Okay. I have to do it. Chapter 14 is the first one. Now, before we do chapter 14 and 19, I have to warn you, chapter 14, because of one verse, is often misinterpreted, and I've got to help you not misinterpret the verse. Okay. In order to do that, I've got to have us read another verse, which we'll do. But chapter 19 is very ambiguous. And unfortunately, those two chapters are the two places, the only two places in the book of Job, where Job has been seen by some people to talk about resurrection and life after death. And so before we go to the two passages, which are either possible to be misunderstood or totally unclear in the Hebrew, we want to talk about a passage which is absolutely clear. And so if we see a passage which is absolutely clear, then that helps us with the passages that are a bit ambiguous. At least that's supposed to help us. Turn to chapter 7, verses 7 to 10. We all ought to agree on what these verses say. Job in chapter 7 is saying how hard his life is. He's like a slave. He says, I don't have time to sleep at night. My sickness is so bad. And I don't have any hope. And now he speaks to God. Or, well, debatable. He speaks to God partly, and he speaks about God partly. Changes. Hebrews often do that. Changes from he to you. Okay, would someone read chapter 7, verses 7 to 10?
Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. While thy eyes are upon me, I shall be gone. As the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He returns no more to his house, nor does his place know him anymore.
Now, those of you who were here on Tuesday, you remember, we spent practically the whole hour talking about the Jewish view of what happens in death. And the dominant Jewish view is, when you're dead, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead. You go to Sheol. Sheol is a place of shadows or shades. Shades are nothingness. They have no real existence. God doesn't interact with them. They don't interact with God. There's neither punishment nor blessing in Sheol. It's a place of nothingness. Most of you remember that? Okay. This passage says that. Can you see that? This passage says, in Sheol, even God doesn't see Job. And Job can't leave Sheol. That there's nothing there, nothing any more than in verse 9, as the cloud fades and vanishes, so is the person who goes to Sheol. Okay? That's a clear passage, yes?
Is that where the Christian scientists get the idea that you pass into nothingness?
Well, it could be. Even some Christian people, believe it or not, apart from Christian scientists, when they talk about life after death or not, they use this Old Testament view and say that in the moment of death, when the body goes to the grave, the life force from God disappears, that you no longer have a human being. We went through this on Tuesday, and maybe if you weren't here, I don't know. Yeah, okay. There are many New Testament writers, when they interpret the New Testament, take that Old Testament view and say that is the view of the New Testament. That ain't so, in my opinion. Because in between the Old Testament and the New, the intertestamental period, Jewish people didn't like that view and said, no, when you die, bad people go to bad places, good people go to the presence of God, good places. So when you get to the New Testament, you have to make a choice between the Old Testament view, where you become nothing, like chapter 7, or the New Testament and current Jewish view for most people, where life exists after death, even though the body is decaying, and then later God will reunite this new body, spiritual body, Paul calls it, with the soul. Now, whether Christian scientists, you see, specifically get it from the Old Testament or not, I don't know. But it is similar to the Old Testament view. Anything else on chapter 7, verses 7 to 10 as background? Do we all agree that's what that says? I'm going to make you vote. Raise your hand if you think that's what that says. Okay. Now we're going to go two passages in Job where Job speaks, and Job cannot easily contradict that. Can you see that? So if the passages are unclear, they have to agree with that. Now if they're crystal clear, that's different. But if they're unclear or ambiguous, then we would use this clear passage to help us understand the unclear one. That's the principle of exegesis, or interpretation, we teach at the seminary. You use clear passages to help you understand unclear passages, not the other way around. Okay, chapter 14. We have time in this class to read the first verses. 14, 1 to 6, shows how bad Job feels, how bad he feels the human condition is. But the passages I'm really interested in start at verse 7. Would somebody then read 14, 1 to 6? Six? And this is, he's speaking to God now.
Man that is born of a woman is a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and withers. He flees like a shadow and continues not.
See, that fits the death, dead, okay.
And dost thou open thy eyes upon such a one and bring him into judgment with thee?
That's cute. He says, look how unimportant man is. They die, they go to nothing. Why worry about such people, God? You've got more important things to do about that. He says that clear in other places, too. That's one of Job's points with God. You're spending too much time on me. Okay, keep going.
Who can bring a living thing out of an unclean? This is not one. There is not one. Since his days are determined, and the number of his months is with thee, and thou hast appointed his bounds that he cannot pass. Look away from him and desist, that he may enjoy, like a hireling, his day.
Hireling is a lousy word. Hireling, you don't know what a hireling is. We don't use it anymore. Anybody have a different translation?
Hired man?
Hired man, not so good. Hired slave. Someone who has got a very good situation at all. Bond servant. A person indentured, you know, that has no way of getting out of his lousy situation. Gets minimum wage for it. He can't quit. He's just got to keep on working and living in those awful conditions. So it's really a bad word, but hireling in English doesn't convey that. Okay, that's Job's understanding. And thinking of human life like that, he looks around in nature and he says, God, it's better in nature. You did a better job out there with the trees than you're doing with us. That's chapter 14, verses 7 to 9. Would somebody read it?
For there is hope for a tree if it be cut down again, that it will sprout again, and that its fruit will not cease. Though its root grow old in the earth, and its stump die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and put forth branches like a young plant.
Now every year, I'm a lousy gardener, I don't like gardening. Every year I've got a hedge around the house. Not only do I have to trim the dumb thing, but in that hedge there are a certain kind of soft wood that grows about twice as fast as the hedge, and it's always way up, and it gets this thick trunk like this, you know. And every year I saw it off right down at the roots, and every year it grows back. What I should do, but I'm too lazy, is dig out the root. That's what Job says will happen. Look at nature. They can die, they can look absolutely dead, but as soon as water comes, those trees are going to show life again. Now he draws an analogy. Wouldn't it be nice if human life were like that? Okay, would someone read verses 10 to 12?
But man dies and lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? As water evaporates from the sea, and a river becomes parched and dried up, so man lies down and does not rise, until the heavens be no more. He will not awake nor be aroused out of his sleep.
Okay, now verse 12 is the problem. See, I'm not hiding the problems. I'm helping you see them. Notice up until verse 12, in the first half of verse 12 even, it's very clear Job is saying, when you're dead, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead, right? Mm-hmm. Now, verse 12 has been read by some people to mean, but he thinks there will come a time, like the Christian resurrection, when the end of the world comes, that there will be something different. That's not what that means. For Job and the people of his time, when the heavens cease, everything ceases. So there's no hope for resurrection or life after death as long as anything exists. Is the point of the way that last verse 12b is. That's been misunderstood a little bit. The only way you can be sure I'm right is by going by the tenor of the whole verse and what he said in chapter 7 and what he says earlier. That when a person dies, they disappear. And then to know, the understanding is that once the world is finished, everything is finished, there's nothing. Yes?
In the revised edition, do you still think it sounds that it doesn't, I don't get
read
that
it.
Feeling at all.
Read it.
So man lies down and rises not again, till the heavens are no more, he will not awake.
Right.
Be aroused out of his sleep.
That's what I'm saying. Because of the way that's worded, you might say when that happens, he will be roused out of his sleep, right?
Well, I'm so obtuse, I don't take it that way.
Well, how do you take it?
Oh, that none of this is going to happen?
Well, that's right. But there are other people, some commentaries even, who have said this wrong thing. I mean, all books aren't right. It has to be my book, then it's right. That was a joke. Okay. Now, that's all hypothetical, and we have to be a little careful. I want the RSV read for the next verses, because we had a translation in the staff which didn't make it hypothetical. Can you see? This is hypothetical. This is the way it is in nature. This is what it is in life, which is different than nature, and sort of a hope. Oh, wouldn't it be nice if, is what follows. And the RSV words it that way, the RSV is right. And then after we've read that, if somebody has a different one, we'll listen to it. Would someone now read verses 13 to 17? And I'm going to interrupt you.
Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in Sheol, that thou wouldst conceal me until thy wrath be past, that thou wouldst appoint me a set time and remember me.
Oh, that's a cute one. That's a cute one. The picture here is like a mother, and she's at the end of her rope, you know. That kid has been bothering, pesting her all day long, and now she's got to get supper ready. It's 2 o'clock, he won't take his nap, and she finally says, go to your room, shut the door, and stay there. And the kid goes in and slams the door, you know. Kid goes in and slams the door, you know. And she goes about, finishes her ironing and makes the supper, and it's just about time for Dad to come home. And she goes, Tommy's still in the room! And she goes, and poor Tommy's weeping. He thought, Mommy, you forgot me. That's what Job says. Job says, oh, since you've got such a mad on God, such an irrational anger at me that I can't understand, let me go down to Sheol where you can't get at me. Sheol's the place of the dead. Hide me in Sheol. Don't let me there. Don't forget me there. Now, you can read that as an intimation of immortality. Not that Job knows that could happen, but sort of like wishing the impossible dream. If only that could happen. Eventually, God will get over his wrath. He's mad at me. And then we'll be back and friends again like we should be. It's a beautiful little picture there. Okay, remember God says about that, Job spoke what was right, not the friends. Okay, would you keep reading, please, 14 to 17.
If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my release should come.
And the word service isn't good. Does anybody have a different translation?
Hope.
Hope? All the days of my hope? No.
Well, this thought gives me hope.
Oh, yeah. But before that, if a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait.
Struggle.
Appointed.
Hard labor is what the Hebrew word means. Hard labor. Service in the sense of forced labor. So he's not very happy with his life. If there were a chance to live after this life, Job says, then I could endure. Notice it's hypothetical. Since there isn't, I don't want to endure. Okay, keep going.
Thou wouldst call and I would answer thee. Thou wouldst long for the work of thy hand.
How do you like that? He says, God, you would long for me if I weren't here. We had such a good thing going. You would miss me. Well, that's what God said. Job is my best one. Of course God would miss him. He's my prime example of what everybody should be like, but he's the only one in the whole world. If God didn't miss anybody else, he would miss Job. Job is not being proud. He's saying, God, you would miss me. Go on.
For then thou wouldst number my steps, thou wouldst not keep watch over my sin. My transgression would be sealed up in a bag, and thou wouldst cover over my iniquity.
Some have said, aha, here Job says he's sinful, and now he's asking for forgiveness. No way! The friends have said he's sinful. So he says, hypothetically, if they're right, God, if you're going to show me when you appear what sins I've done, I know you're the kind of God who forgives them. You're not going to keep plaguing me with them. He's not saying I've sinned and therefore forgive me. He says, I know, God, that even if you could show me a sin, you're the kind of God who would forgive it and cover it up. You cannot make this mean Job now, against everything the writer said, everything Job has said, everything God has said, to mean Job now says he's sinful. That's what his friends have said, and it's hypothetical. Okay, all the way through, did you notice the words wouldst? You wouldst call. That's hypothetical in English. Does anybody have a different translation they want to read of verses 14 to 17? Anybody with a different translation would be all right.
I got a question.
Okay. We'll skip the other translation. Not important. It's wrong. This is right.
Back in the 13th verse that we just read,
yes.
And he says, if only you would hide me in the grave and conceal me, your anger has passed. If you will, if only you would set me free. Then he says, and then remember me. So does that indicate that he's thinking that he can come back from the grave?
No, that's what I was saying. It's all what he wishes, what is true.
All right.
So the picture is, God is mad. Man's God. Okay. And all his wrath is hitting poor Job. And Job says, hey, God, you've got all power. Move me down here to Sheol. You can't get there. And then, later, when you've forgotten about being angry, then bring me out. But he doesn't say it's going to happen. He says, wouldn't it be nice if it did happen?
Like a temporary leave.
Temporary leave. Very good.
This translation says, but mark your calendar, so like it's going to be
in. Read it!
It says, oh, that
is this
you,
the Living Bible?
Yeah, oh, that you hide me with the dead and forget me there until your anger ends. But mark your calendar to think of me again.
What would we say today? We wouldn't say mark your calendar. He doesn't want to. Set your timer. Yeah. That's what my wife does every half hour. Sets the timer so she doesn't forget the dryer. For all you mothers, set the timer so you don't forget the kid in the room. Okay. Now we'll go to the second one, because I think you can see that's not very difficult. You can see that's all hypothetical. But the next one has been taken over largely on the basis of the King James translation into Handel's Messiah, and we sing it and hear it every Easter as the greatest Old Testament statement of the sure hope of resurrection, right? Isn't that what we hear?
Yeah.
Every Easter. Beautiful. Love Handel's Messiah. Unfortunately, it's not what the text says. That will take some doing. So, what we're going to do now, first I'm going to have somebody read the RSV. Then after that's done, we're going to have somebody else read their translation, whatever it is. And then we're going to have a third translation, and we'll even let the Living Bible be read. Then when we've had all of that, I'll go through the verses, and I'll translate very literally what the Hebrew says. And you will have to wrestle with which of those translations did the best job, okay? So, RSV first, chapter 19. Well, before we do that, I should introduce it a little, I suppose. We're interested in chapter 19, verses 23 to 27, but only especially 25 to 27. And if you look at 23 with me for a minute, oh, that my words were written, oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Book is a lousy word. They didn't have books. It means either on a rock, inscribed, or on a scroll, but that doesn't matter. Job says, what I'm going to say now should be there for all posterity in case I die. I want a living memorial after me of my position. Okay? So in verse 23 and then verse 24. Notice, oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were graven in the rock forever. He doesn't know whether he's going to live or die. He doesn't know what the future is, but he wants to put it down in an inscription writing which cannot be altered, even by time and rain, so people will know what the situation is. That's how strong he feels about verses 25 to 27, okay? Now, somebody read the RSV of 25 to 27.
For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me.
Beautiful passage, isn't it? Now, anybody has any other translation, read it. Tell us what translation you have. Anyway.
New International.
New International.
I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, and not another. How my heart yearns within me.
Okay. So it's basically the same thing in the RSV. It's beautiful, isn't it? Want a different translation. Somebody's going to have a better one. Yes, sir. What is yours?
This is Good News.
Okay. That'll probably come out a little better, I hope.
But I know there is someone in heaven who will come at last to my defense. Even after my skin is eaten by a disease, while still in this body, I will see God. I will see him with my own eyes, and he will not be a stranger.
That should be one more line.
My courage failed because you said, and then it goes on to verse 28.
My courage failed. That's got some of the things showing the difference. You could see that's a little different, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Let's have the Living Bible. Does anybody have the Jerusalem Bible here? That had a good... No. Okay, read the...
But as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he will stand upon the earth at last. And I know that after this body has decayed, this body shall see God. Then he will be on my side. Yes, I shall see him, not as a stranger, but as a friend. What a glorious hope.
That's nice, huh? You all like the Living Bible this morning, don't you? Unfortunately, it ain't what the Hebrew says yet. Anybody have something that's less nice than all of that?
That's good.
Good to get the Jerusalem Bible. It's in the reference shelf. While we're waiting for that, any other translation anybody have? Yes, what's yours? King James, that'll be too much like all of this. Won't help us. We know the King James, but I know that my Redeemer lives for the latter day. He will stand upon the earth. No worms destroy this, my body. And so we know that one. Any other one? No other Bibles? No different one. Okay, we'll get the Jerusalem Bible. Maybe you can't find it. Got it?
One or two
times. That's pretty big. You might look in the wrong place. It opened right to Job 42.
Well, that was nice.
Job 19. I don't want to use it. I use my voice too much. Would somebody read? It starts at the top up here. Is verse 27. No, 25 to 27.
This I know, that my Avenger lives, and he, the last, will take his stand on earth. After my awaking, he will set me close to him, and from my flesh I shall look on God. He whom I shall see will take my part. These eyes will gaze on him and find him not aloof. My heart within me sinks.
Okay. So, can you see? Translators don't agree? Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to tell you what it says. I'm going to go through it. You can follow whatever you have. And there'll be certain words that I'll explain what they mean, a range of meanings, and you can see why one translator takes this, another one takes that. Okay. For I know that my Goel lives. The Hebrew word there is the word Goel. That Hebrew word has specific meanings. The first meaning of Goel is a relative, kinsman in the Bible. Relative. And a near relative had a certain job to do. Let's say that someone has brought a false case, a false accusation against me, and so I'm in prison. It is the Goel's job, the near kinsman's job, to go out and clear my name so that my honor will be seen to be what it truly is rather than the false accusation. Got that?
Yes.
Secondly, in a culture, as at that time, where they had blood feuds, where if somebody was accidentally killed or killed on purpose by someone of a different family or tribe, it was the job of the goel, the kinsman, the near relative, to go out and kill the other guy. Avenger, in this translation. That's legitimate. Okay. Third, if I go to war and I get captured by the enemy, and at that time, people who were captured in war, if they weren't killed, they all became slaves of the enemy. It was the job of the goel to go and get me back, usually by paying a ransom. You could ransom captives back from enemies. That's where the word redeemer sneaks in. A redeemer is one who buys back. I had forgotten that normal meaning until I got to India, and I used to pay the monthly stipends to the students, and one of my students, married student, came early, said, I need my stipend a little early, and I'm very hard-nosed, and I always ask him, well, why do you need it early? Because if I gave it to him, then next month he'd be farther behind, you see, the problem. And he said, well, I have to go redeem my watch. Redeem your watch. Then it dawned on me. Oh, that's the real meaning of redeem. He had taken his watch to the pawn shop to get money so he could buy rice for his family. And now he wants to get his watch back, so he wants his monthly income a little early. So he go and get his watch back, redeem it. That's what a goel did. A goel redeemed, bought back. Now when we hear the word redeemer, we think Jesus Christ dying on the cross, sins of the world. That's a very late meaning. If you put the word redeemer in this text, maybe you shouldn't capitalize it. See, the RSV capitalized it. Maybe you should. Maybe he does think of God there, you know. But do you see the ambiguity? Okay. Wasn't there another meaning? Let's see, I thought I had a fourth.
On the bottom of the page in my RSV for that word, it says vindicated.
Right, and that was the first one. I should have mentioned, thank you. RSV notes, vindicator means your honor has been falsified, and he vindicates that your honor is right. Okay. If you capitalize vindicator, it means God. If you don't capitalize vindicator, it means anybody. The text doesn't say whether it's God or not, does it? So you have to make a choice whether you're going to capitalize redeemer and use the word redeemer, capitalize avenger and use the word avenger, or capitalize vindicator and use the word vindicator. Now, thinking of everything that's gone on, Job, his friends, which word would you pick? Let's take a vote quick. How many would pick avenger? Nobody. How many would pick redeemer? A few. How many would pick vindicator? The RSV put it in the footnote. Why? Because they knew all of us grew up on the word redeemer and didn't want to take it out because they would even be accused more of taking the truth out of the Bible. You grow up in a passage and say it one way, you let a translator take that out and see how well you like that guy. So, the RSV should, if they were being true to themselves and the context, probably put vindicator there. Because he wants God to vindicate his innocence, right? And it could be capitalized or not, but Job thinks God will have to do it. So I would capitalize vindicator. Wouldn't put it in a footnote. I'd put it up there. Okay, next one. For I know that my vindicator lives. Excuse me. And at last. Notice how the translators didn't know what to do with that? At last can mean at the last moment, just before I die, or it could mean at last after this life is over, using Christian terms, when the parousia comes, you know? And then the Jerusalem Bible said, the last one, the last person who will vindicate me will come. Finally, my only hope, which is probably God, will come. So the word only says at last, and you don't know what it means. You don't mean whether at last before I die, at last after I'm dead, or does it mean as a last person? The Hebrew is not clear. Okay? He will stand on the earth. The Hebrew has dust. Now you can see what earth does. Anybody who stands on the earth, the picture is God coming down from heaven, standing on earth, declaring to the whole world. Right? That's what it means. It means Job, probably on his dust heap where he's sitting, suffering from this, either dying or while he's just about dead, his vindicator will come right to his problem, his need, and will vindicate him in that situation. Dust would probably be better than earth. Earth gives a different picture, but you can't prove it. It's ambiguous. The word can mean either. Okay, now, then notice the next verse. And after my skin has been thus, it said destroyed. There's another word some translators should have. I didn't hear it. Flayed off. Picture is of a person being whipped. And the whip tears the skin off and exposes the raw flesh. And Job says, that's what God's doing to me. And when he's done flaying off my skin, so my quivering raw flesh is exposed. Then, the word is without in my RSV, without my flesh. Your RSV said from my flesh. Mine's the earlier, mine's 1952, yours is later. What does the footnote say in the Bible?
Without.
Without. When they translated it first, they said without. Then, when they translated it the next time, they said with. Can be understood two ways. Could mean with my flesh while I'm still alive before I die. Quivering raw flesh. Could mean after I'm dead, bodily resurrection, flesh restored. I think the RSV changed because there were a lot of complaints, you know, about Redeemer, about bodily resurrection or not. I don't know. Don't know why they did. The Hebrew word only says from. And you don't know whether it means, as the Hebrew word means, without, away from, or it means in my flesh. The Hebrew is unclear. That's why the RSV changed its mind. That's why different translations dealt with it differently. Some make the clear reference to a resurrected body there even. It's not in the text. It's ambiguous. Then, from my flesh, I shall see God. And then I have a footnote. Would somebody read the footnote in the RSV?
The meaning of this verse is uncertain.
Do you agree?
Yeah.
Yes. So no matter what they do, see, no translator is going to translate nonsense in a printed Bible. They're going to make it come out to some meaning. And so what the translator thinks or wants will determine the translation. And most of the translations we read took the ambiguity away on the side of the King James and Handel's Messiah. But that doesn't fit very well, can you see, with Job chapter 7 and Job chapter 14. Okay, now verse 27, whom I shall see on my side, the RSV says. The Hebrew word there can either mean beside me, next to me, physically, or on my side, in a case, in court, defending me. The word means either one. As one who is defending me or one who is standing beside me, I'm in the presence of God. And my eyes shall behold, and not another, the RSV says. That's literally what the Hebrew says. But the word another has two meanings. It can mean my eyes and not somebody else's eyes. But the Hebrew construction doesn't fit very well with that. But some of the translations took it that way. It fits better to take it the way other translators took it, whom I will see no longer as a stranger. The word another means somebody who is different, not a friend, but a stranger. And that's probably what Job is saying. Remember how he felt? God, why do you appear as an enemy to me? And he says, God will eventually appear to me as a friend. Again, you have to decide in the context which makes the most sense. The word can mean either one. That's the problem. And then when it gets all done with that, the RSV says, my heart faints within me. And that can be interpreted two ways. And I didn't do it. You find it translated. Isn't it wonderful? I can hardly believe it. My heart faints with the beauty of this thought I've just had. That's how we take it. Or Job is exhausted. He doesn't have hope. And somebody says, my courage fails. So, You decide now. Is this a passage that shows Job has the sure hope of resurrection and eternal life with God? Or is it a passage which doesn't show that? Or is it a passage you don't know what it says?
Amen.
Amen. We don't know what it says. That's where we're at. So, but it's been the passage which has given us the beautiful passage in Handel's Messiah, which expresses a truth that is true about Jesus Christ and what God does for us, but it does not express, as I see it, what the writer said Job felt. Now, that's all I had to cover this morning. Tomorrow we'll get to God's response to Job. You can have questions for 6 minutes.
If we interpret the unclear in the light of the clear, the New Testament certainly is much more clear. And is it so wrong to go back and use the King James Version?
Yes. I'll tell you why, though. I'm not just saying, but I'll show you why. When we use that principle, explain the unclear by the clear in exegesis, in interpretation, we mean in the same document by the same writer, where that writer has told us what he thinks. It doesn't mean I can explain Isaiah by Jeremiah, or Jeremiah by Genesis, or Genesis by the New Testament. And the way some of you were here last week, how many were here last week? There we talked about inspiration, and part of it was, how do the New Testament writers use the Old? This will just take a minute. Isaiah 6 is quoted by 3 New Testament writers. Isaiah 6 is inspired, and each of the New Testament writers are inspired, but they all interpret Isaiah 6 differently. Which New Testament writer do I use? You see the problem? So when we use the principle in interpretation, we don't find a solution anywhere in the New and put it on the Old, but we use the Old Testament passage and book to explain that Old Testament passage is the basic principle. Now that raises a whole lot of things, and if you weren't here, you might enjoy listening. That was the Wednesday tape, the Wednesday tape last week, the third one in the series, which dealt with Isaiah and showed how Matthew, Mark, and John deal with the same Old Testament passage, radically different. Yes?
I'm going to make a statement, not a question.
Okay, she doesn't want me to respond to that. My wife says I get carried away and I answer more than anybody ever asks. Go ahead.
In spite of the fact that right now I maybe have been a little bit disillusioned because I was banking on this passage here in Job, as we all have, I'm going to really hang on to that statement, and I am going to hang on to Handel's interpretation, and I'm going to hang on to the Easter hymn that we sing.
I agree with you, because it expresses a Christian truth. The only point I disagree is not what Job said, nor the writer's book of Job. But I agree with it. I hang on to it too. I have a sure hope in the resurrection of life. I believe that when I die because of, I said this last week in the week before, when I die because of what God has done for me in Christ, I will immediately be with him in his presence. I will not be sleeping. I will not be dead when I'm dead when I'm dead. And I believe that when Christ returns, if he doesn't return while I'm alive, like Paul said he might, but he returns after I've died, that I will be taken, my body will be taken to join with my soul to be with him. So I agree with you 100%. It ain't what Job or the writer of the book of Job says, as I see it.
Well, what Claudia said there is that's what the New Testament writers do all the time with Old Testament stuff. They reinterpret it.
Right.
And use it,
right.
Which is what Handel did with Job.
And I say, yes, we all do it, and we should see God lets his inspired New Testament writers do different things with the same passage, and that makes us very cautious about using one person to give the interpretation. That's all I was trying to say there. If 3 inspired writers use the same passage differently, I got a problem. I agree with everything else that's been said.
Systematically you do, but not liturgically.
Well, of course not, but I'm not a liturgist. I'm a New Testament and Old Testament exegete. So I can agree what we do liturgically, but not say it's the meaning of this historically.
Would you make a statement about all of the preoccupation, you know, that some people have with death and dying, you know, and the handy books by Kubler Ross and God knows what not, and quite a number of other books, how people gotten out of their skin and every now and then came back and all this sort of jazz.
Okay, I'll make my statement. You can do with what you want.
Yeah.
None of us know. None of us know what happens in the moment of death, what life after death is like. The New Testament and the Old Testament only speaks in human terms about that reality. We don't even know what God is like. The New Testament and the Old Testament, you and I speak in human terms about God. And they're always imperfect, and they're always wrong. They're partly right, partly wrong. So I don't know what is the state of people after death. I know what I believe will happen to me. That's faith, but not knowledge. That's the only statement I can make in the few times we have. Nobody knows. The New Testament doesn't. The Old Testament doesn't know. They describe a certain relation to God as an act of faith.
In other words, it could be, as you said before, if you have poor theology, you go into a theophany.
It doesn't mean that's right, but that's the way some people look at it.
Yeah, they claim a miracle.
Yeah. We have time for one more question before we let you leave. Anybody have one more? Okay, well, I knew this was going to be a toughie. Anytime anybody touches a passage we love.
I just want to say that our walk is by faith and not by sight. And it's the Holy Spirit that makes clear to me.
Someplace I heard that in the New Testament.
Right.
Very good. We'll come back to that tomorrow, believe it or not.
Great.
Yes.
Sorry. Will you stick around for a little bit?
Yes.
Some who won't be here tomorrow.
Yes, right. Anybody who won't be here tomorrow, I'll explain the message of Joel.
My goodness, you'll do all that.